Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. It's a little hard to pronounce that name, so exotic. Mudin.
Might move over to my married name, Sparrow.
That's even worse because they're spelling
Sparrow.
It. Yeah, I know. You could.
Nobody could pronounce it, by the way.
But the spelling,
yeah.
How do you spell it?
S-Z-P-A-R-A.
There's too few vowels in that.
So I went from one difficult last name to another difficult last name. I can't win.
Okay, it's easy to say Sparrow.
Sparrow. The Z is silent.
Okay.
That's the rule.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. So, but we're not going to change your name.
No. It's all right.
Purposes. It's Layla.
Dr. Hoffman got a new nutritionist.
Right. So, anyway, I just want to mention before we get into the podcast that some people have asked us, since these podcasts are heard across the country, around the world, is there a way to consult or with the Hoffman Center get a question answered nutritionally? And unfortunately, I can't enter into your problem as a medical doctor without seeing you and undergoing a routine intake physical exam. It's my medical responsibility to do so, medical, legally. However, there is an avenue by which you can get a nutritional consult with Layla Mudin, and now you have patients from all over the country. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a little more challenging to speak to patients all over the world, but certainly patients from all over the country who have their doctors in place are communicating with you, sharing test results with you,
mm-hmm.
And you're giving them nutritional guidance for whatever medical condition or
yes.
health concern they have. So that is possible. Via drhoffman.com, find out about how you can become a patient of Layla's, and you will garner some of the self-same benefits of the expertise that you hear we share each week on Q&A with Layla. Okay, that being said, our next question has to do with...
With, this person writes, and we don't have a name here, everything I've read says that UC2, also known as Rumishield, is superior to glucosamine products. What say you, Dr. Hoffman?
Okay. Mm. UC2, undenatured collagen type 2, was actually developed by a Harvard rheumatologist. And the notion is that by feeding a little bit of collagen, it's not so much a building block for collagen in the body in this form. Mm-hmm. It actually kind of runs interference against the body's autoimmune attack on collagen.
Uh-huh.
So it is a an agent that acts as a blocker of autoimmunity.
Huh.
And you can't just use collagen. You have to use undenatured collagen type 2. It's a certain type of collagen. I'm pulling up a study here that shows that patients treated with undenatured collagen type 2 had about a 20% improvement after 90 days of treatment for osteoarthritis. Okay, and this was actually precisely what was looked at. The present clinical trial, what the questioner asked about, the present clinical trial evaluated the safety and efficacy of UC2 as compared to a combination of glucosamine and chondroitin. And it says, although both the treatments reduced the pain score or disability score, UC2 treatment decreased the score by 40% after 90 days as compared to 15% in the glucosamine plus chondroitin treated group.
Wow.
So, so that's good. It suggests,
great.
Now what it suggests, and this study didn't look at it, is what happens when you have a synergy, and I'm not sure that there's a study that looks at both. Suggestion is that you use both because they do different things. Glucosamine chondroitin, actually more acts, as a building block rather than as a blocking factor. Now, originally, I just used UC2, uninatured collagen type 2, in rheumatoid arthritis because it was originally intended for that. But then it was now found that it works in different form of arthritis, osteoarthritis. So
wow.
RumaShield is a product you take generally away from food at bedtime, two capsules at bedtime, and it's worth keeping in mind if you have osteoarthritis.
Terrific.
Yeah. So, you know, also in our armamentarium against osteoarthritis are boswellin and curcumin and fish oil. According to Dr. Kaufman, niacinamide may have anti-inflammatory effects, particularly osteoarthritis in the knees seems to be amenable to that. So, you know, those are some of the options.
Wow. Wow. That's fascinating. Thank you for your question. All right. We've got an email from Mike. Hello, Dr. Hoffman. I have adult female friends, typically between 25 and 35 pounds overweight, who say if they don't eat every 3 hours, they feel nauseated and sick. Their food intake is not really from healthy sources. Is this a condition that's caused by training themselves to eat these foods so often and then feeling withdrawal symptoms? Or is there some kind of medical condition behind this? Well, this smells to me of either unstable blood sugar, adrenal stress, which kind of go hand in hand, or food allergy.
Yes,
withdrawal
very good.
From food allergy.
Right.
All of the above.
Right.
So that might be something.
Well, unstable blood sugar certainly can be a cause of feeling kind of sick. You know, when you go too long without eating, it could be a withdrawal from the foods, or it could be, I mean, frankly, it's almost like a rationale. Some people are fearful of the sensation of emptiness or hunger, and they feel that they're going into some sort of meltdown, and they use food to assuage that feeling. And then they sometimes come up with a medical justification. Well, if I don't eat frequently, I get sick. I have hypoglycemia, so I have to eat. And, you know, there may be something to that, but when you're using it as an excuse to eat junk food or poor quality food...
Then you're going to continue having hypoglycemia, you're going to continue having the same symptoms.
I find that tired people tend to require eating all the time because they don't have tuned up glycogen storage. It's actually worthwhile to train your glycogen storage a little bit with, you know, fasts or, you know, going overnight to stopping eating at 7 or 8 o'clock and then having your first meal at noon. So you train your body to store glycogen better. I think I've successfully done that because most of my workouts in the morning are on totally an empty stomach. I just have water or maybe a little decaf. And then, you know, I do it. And it's all coming, I've fasted overnight. It's all coming from the glycogen I've stored earlier. And I have no problem doing that. Unless, you know, I'm going to do a long race or like a very, very long run.
Then you may need a little sustenance.
Not even a run, but a bike ride, like a 2-3 hour bike ride. I'll get to a point where I've used up all the glycogen. I just hit the wall. You know, I need to have a little bit of some kind of sugary solution to replete it, you know, in an extraordinary effort, you know, maybe more than 30 miles.
Yeah.
But that's the way it should be. And that this is not good when people have that type of problem.
That's true. The antidote to Mike's female friends here is to eat some protein at every meal, to eat healthfully, first of all, to get away from the junk food. It could also be a matter of allergic addiction, which is really, really interesting. Most of the foods that we crave are often what's causing the problem to begin with. And a withdrawal symptom can be anything. It could be any feeling of malaise, including nausea.
Right.
And feeling sick.
Well, you know, I have to also say that a cardinal symptom of gastritis is that when your stomach is empty, you have nausea. So that has to, you know, I'm probably not likely, but it has to be mentioned, is that some people need this, like, a soothing presence of food in their stomach because they actually have a little bit of irritation in their stomach. And so people who, when they're hungry, have pain. It's a little bit of a concern that maybe they have a gastritis or an ulcer. But I'm thinking that this is just garden variety
nausea
that's due to low blood sugar and or withdrawal. With a heaping tablespoon of rationalization about,
probably.
You know, I gotta eat. You know,
I have to have more of that junk I had 3 hours ago because I feel sick. Okay,
yeah, I once had a holistic doctor come to my house. It was when I was first in practice, and he was one of the senior people on the field. It wasn't Dr. Atkins, I'll tell you that much.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great honor for me to prepare a dinner for him.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never met him before, and he was really famous and rich. And he came to my door. At the time, my medical center was actually in a brownstone, and I had a kitchen, and I prepared the meal very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And he knocked at the door, and I went to the door, and I opened the door, and without even shaking my hand, he looked around and said, "I have hypoglycemia. I have to eat right now." And he just rushed past me and into the kitchen, and I fed him.
Right now.
And I said, "This is a very strange introduction to this doctor." And maybe he did have hypoglycemia, but it seems to me like he just wanted to eat.
Oh, my goodness. Can I ask what you fed him?
Chicken.
Chicken. All
high
right.
High protein.
There you
Already
go.
Already we were into like a high protein diet even
Oh, that's funny. Wow. So, Mike, thank you very, very much for your question.
I think he devoured a whole chicken.
Wow.
Then he started talking. Then we had.
And then he started.
He was hangry. He was hangry.
For people who don't know what hangry is, it's being hungry and angry, and a symptom of low blood sugar is becoming cranky and angry.
Right,
it happens to a lot of people.
Well, now it's made famous by these commercials on TV of like
Snickers bars or
Snickers
something.
Snickers bars, right.
Are you hangry?
Right.
Fight your hanger. Your
well,
hanger.
That's not the way to fight your hangry with Snickers bars. That's
right.
It's a funny ad, but it's the diametrically opposite approach of what you should do.
Now, there was a time decades ago when doctors would recommend for hypoglycemia, oh, just eat a candy bar.
Yes.
No. One of the best things you could do is carry around some nuts.
I had a girlfriend once in college. This is how misinformed we were. And, you know, when we started dating, she said, "Look, there's something you need to know about me." I said, "What?" And she said, "Well, from time to time, I get really lightheaded and woozy. And so when that happens, what you need to do is you need to go to the first, newsstand.
Uh-huh.
And if I'm on the street or, you know, if I'm at home, reach in the cabinet and get me a candy bar because I have low blood sugar." And,
wow.
I said, and in those days, I didn't know anything. But I said, "Oh, it's fine. You know, I'll, you know, and
uh-huh.
I hope she's okay today, 40 years later."
Hopefully. Oh, my.
Yeah.
Wow.
Hope she's not diabetic by now.
Wow. Okay. We've got an email from Marianne. "Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, my 74-year-old female cousin recently came down with shingles on her cheek, and this happened after she had to use an inhaler for asthma after a severe bout with bronchitis.
Mm-hmm.
Can the inhaler compromise the immune system?"
Well, the answer is maybe, because we know that certain events, stress or immunosuppressive medication, can cause the zoster, herpes zoster, which is the virus responsible for chickenpox, but also shingles, to reemerge from the nerves that it hides in. After a bout of chickenpox, it will not disappear from your body. It's forever. Herpes viruses are retained by the body.
Mm-hmm.
They're latent. But it can go into hiding and never reemerge, or under conditions of immunosuppression, aging, stress, it can come out. It is well known, for example, when people go on these immunosuppressive medications, you know, high-dose steroids or immunosuppressive drugs they now use for autoimmunity, that sometimes zoster emerges. And
cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy.
Cancer patients, absolutely. So they're particularly, I mean, people ask me about the shingles vaccine. Under those circumstances, I think it's probably wise to get a protective vaccine.
What about for somebody who's never had chickenpox? Do you think they should get a shingles vaccine, or is that even?
Well, that's it's an interesting question, because they should be, I mean, now they're vaccines for chickenpox. They should be getting the chickenpox vaccine.
Right, right.
The vast majority of people who are young never had chickenpox, but they got the vaccine. So,
right.
In effect, they've got an immunity to it, and they will not be candidates for getting zoster later.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing, by the way, the zoster vaccine, Zostrex, it's called, I think, is it's going to fade, you know, mm-hmm. after this generation dies off, because people coming up through the ranks will have been vaccinated against chickenpox.
I see. Okay.
That's my belief.
Interesting. Wow. Marianne, we hope your cousin feels better. Thank you for your question. Okay. We've got an email from Wayne. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I've heard you talk about the benefits of having optimal levels of vitamin D. So 6 years ago, I started taking some vitamin D3. I don't remember the dose. And then within 6 months, I developed a calcium oxalate kidney stone. I stopped taking it. I went on a low oxalate diet. I stopped eating spinach.
This is with vitamin C?
With vitamin D.
D?
With vitamin D.
D as in dog, okay.
Yeah, with D as in dog. Anyway, that was 6 years ago. In April 2015, I started taking vitamin D3 again, about 5,000 IU per day. Had my levels checked. My levels were 48. And then a few months later, I developed another calcium oxalate kidney stone. Is this happening from the vitamin D?
The answer to that is it's unlikely. It's unlikely because
yeah.
the vast majority of people have even higher vitamin Ds do mm-hmm. not get kidney stones from vitamin D. So there may be other reasons this person's getting stones.
Yeah.
I mean, some people are genetically stone formers. Some people have too low levels of magnesium or citric acid, citrate.
Yeah.
We can sometimes determine that through a urine test that shows the balance of what's in the urine. Too much sodium can provoke stones. Curiously enough, calcium intake is not necessarily associated with stones. It was once thought that high-dose vitamin C was associated with stones, but some of our patients get tremendous amounts of vitamin C,
yeah.
100 grams, you know, several times a week for cancer, and they never get stones.
Yeah.
So unless this person has hypercalcemia, which is something that I guess could be slightly worsened by vitamin D, usually not, but that's a high level of calcium in the blood or a high level of calcium in the urine, this can be checked with a blood test.
Yeah.
Or if the person has hyperparathyroidism, elevated parathyroid hormone, that can lead to stone formation. So, go to a urologist.
Yeah.
If you've had so many episodes, get a complete workup, find out why you're such a stone former. I doubt it's the vitamin D.
In the meantime, take some magnesium citrate.
Potassium citrate is another one. Potassium citrate by prescription and magnesium mm-hmm. citrate by, over the counter will help.
Right.
And also vitamin B6 seems to have an anti-stone effect a little bit.
Okay. Best of luck to you, Wayne. Hopefully no more kidney stones for you. Okay. We've got an email from Frank. Speaking of hyperparathyroidism. Frank says, I'm a dialysis patient with secondary hyperparathyroidism, and my nephrologist advised me that my parathyroid gland should be removed because of the damage and the calcification it could do to blood vessels, the heart. Is there a way I could avoid the surgery and do something naturally?
This is a little bit of a technical question. First of all, we're talking about hyperparathyroidism, which is the parathyroids are tiny glands, four of them that sit on top of the thyroid. That's why they're called parathyroids. They are responsible for calcium metabolism, and when they're overactive, they cause excess absorption of calcium from the diet and mm-hmm. a high blood level of calcium. So the way to treat hyperparathyroidism is normally to get rid of your parathyroids, unless there's a reason mm-hmm. that the parathyroids are high that you can address. Now, in renal failure, what happens is these patients are vitamin D
That's
deficient.
Right. He's on dialysis. Yeah.
They're vitamin D deficient. So, well before doctors were routinely prescribing vitamin D, nephrologists were prescribing vitamin D because they knew that when your kidneys weren't working, you could not actually produce what's called 125 hydroxy vitamin D, which
yeah.
is the actual business
calcitriol,
end.
Calcitriol. Yeah.
Yeah. Calcitriol, which is the really the business end of the vitamin D hormone.
Right.
So without that, the parathyroid works overtime to absorb calcium and then gets hypertrophied, enlarged, or hyperactive.
Wow.
That's why it's called secondary.
Uh-huh.
There is a reason. There's a cause. Most people have what's called primary hyperparathyroidism, which is we don't know why that occurred. It's just the parathyroid's enlarged. It's not clear why. Secondary once, you know, maybe in the early stages could be treated with vitamin D.
Okay.
But I think he's crossed the Rubicon, so to speak, to the point where he needs to shut down that excess parathyroid production.
Hmm.
Otherwise, he's going to have excess calcium and all the consequences. So what are his symptoms? He has...
That's it. The secondary hyperparathyroidism.
He doesn't have stones. He doesn't have...
No, he doesn't have stones. His nephrologist is worried because of the calcification, possibly to his blood vessels and his heart because of...
A lot of calcium, you know, high blood levels of calcium.
And he's on dialysis, so that makes everything tricky.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
That just changes the reference ranges of everything.
Right.
So that's very interesting.
What are supplements we like for people on dialysis? We like carnitine, for example.
Carnitine. And acetylcysteine, would that be during dialysis to help?
Well, it's actually more for renal failure, you know, for like progressing towards renal failure. I think he's already had renal failure.
Mm-hmm.
Omega-3 fish oils. Most of these patients are hypogonadal, you know, like low DHA, low testosterone. These are some of the things that need to be addressed.
Yeah. And I would say with lots of supervision because...
CoQ10 helps some of these patients too.
Yeah. CoQ10 seems to help everybody with everything.
And we have to watch out because some nutrients do not get properly excreted by the kidneys and they can build up.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to give too much of certain things. They just build up and overaccumulate.
Mm-hmm.
Even magnesium, which is a safe nutrient by and large, you have to be careful and limited in people who are on dialysis.
Yes, yes,
It's sort of a specialty thing. I think you know a little bit about how to treat dialysis patients or renal failure patients with, you know, what you can use and what you have to avoid.
Right, right, right. Frank, best of luck to you. Okay, he should listen to his nephrologist.
Yes, unfortunately, in this case, yes.
Okay.
Okay, so that's all the time that we have for today's edition of our weekly Q&A with Layla. It's been fun. And we encourage you to continue submitting your questions to a radio program at AOL.com. That's how you get through to us. So we'll answer as many of them as we can. And we wish you a very healthy week. Thanks, Layla, for joining us.
Thanks, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you, everybody.